From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Last week, Colonel Margaret Kammermeyer was discharged from the Army for being a lesbian. She's one of the highest-ranking military officials to be let go because of sexual orientation. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Kammermeyer about her life in the military and why she plans on challenging military policy on gays in federal court. Also, how developers and conservationists are working together in the developing world. We talk with Roger Stone of the World Wildlife Fund. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews Jay Leno's Tonight Show, now in its second week. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The members of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization took a major step today toward expanding the alliance's role as a peacekeeper. For the first time since it was founded in 1949, NATO agreed to go beyond the task of defending its 16 member states. NATO chief Manfred Werner told reporters that the alliance would provide supplies, transportation, and possibly troops for peacekeeping operations if all its allies agreed. Any peacekeeping operation would first have to be requested by the 52-nation Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe. The United States tried and failed to get the NATO allies to go one step further and consider military intervention, if necessary, to back up the UN sanctions against Serbia. In Serbia, the government announced the outcome of elections held 4 days ago. The vote, considered illegal by the international community, gave a resounding victory to the Socialist Party of Slobodan Milosevic. NPR's Silvia Poggioli reports.
The elections were scheduled hastily only a month ago to give legitimacy to the rump Yugoslavia formed by Serbia and its ally Montenegro. Opposition parties refused to take part and called on voters to boycott the ballot. The government announced that turnout was 56%. In Serbia, Milosevic's Socialist Party scored 43% and the ultra-nationalist Radical Party won 30%, with the rest going to minor parties. Opposition leaders today denounced the elections as a rigged farce and said they are planning peaceful protest demonstrations to bring down the Milosevic regime. This is Silvia Poggioli in Belgrade.
In Hong Kong, tens of thousands of people rallied today to mark the third anniversary of China's crackdown on the democracy movement. NPR's Deborah Wong filed this report.
About 20,000 people gathered peacefully in Hong Kong's Victoria Park, holding white candles and singing pro-democracy songs and hymns to the dead. The demonstrators laid wreaths of flowers around a replica of the goddess of democracy, the symbol of the Chinese protest movement that was brutally crushed 3 years ago today. The crackdown in Beijing sent shockwaves through Hong Kong, a British colony which is to become a part of China in just 5 years' time. Many residents fear as long as there is no democracy in China, their future under Chinese rule is not guaranteed. I'm Deborah Wong in Hong Kong.
Stock prices closed slightly lower today on Wall Street as investors waited for tomorrow's unemployment figures and other signs of how well the economy is performing. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 7 points to close at 3,399.7. Declines led advances by 9-7 in heavy trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was about 204 million shares. This is NPR. The head of the Securities and Exchange Commission told a Senate panel today that attempts to limit the pay of U.S. corporate executives could do more harm than good. Executive pay in the United States has increased by 75% in the past decade. Senator David Boren told the panel that U.S. executives make about 100 times as much as their average workers, as opposed to executives in Japan who make about 17 times as much. Atlanta's Hartsfield International Airport, one of the nation's busiest, is open again after shutting down for 2 hours this morning. Sid Hoskinson of Peach State Public Radio reports.
Airport officials now say a problem with an escalator caused the foul-smelling fumes that forced them to evacuate the terminals and close the airport to all incoming cars and commuter trains. First reports were that there was a natural gas leak. The Federal Aviation Administration says airplanes continued to take off and land normally during the time Hartsfield's terminals were shut down, and airport officials say passengers on connecting flights who didn't need to go into the terminals were not affected. But they say the two-hour shutdown may have caused some passengers expecting to catch flights in Atlanta to miss their planes. For National Public Radio, I'm Sid Hoskinson in Atlanta.
The major television networks have proposed four nationally televised debates for the leading presidential candidates and their running mates. ABC, CBS, CNN, and NBC said today that the debates could be staged during September and October from studios in New York, Atlanta, Chicago, and Los Angeles. Three of the exchanges would be for the presidential candidates and one for the vice presidential contenders. There'd be no live audiences under the network plan, and network anchors would guide the discussion. The network plan has been opposed by the Private Commission on Presidential Debates, established in 1986 as a nonpartisan corporation to plan such events. The commission wants debates in public settings. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On June 11th, Colonel Margaret Kammermeyer must end her career in the military. She's being discharged because she is a lesbian. About 1,000 men and women are forced out each year because they are homosexuals. Colonel Kammermeyer is one of the highest-ranking officials ever to be discharged for homosexuality. She's the chief nurse of the Washington State Army National Guard. She has served nearly 27 years and was awarded a Bronze Star for her tour in Vietnam. In 1985, she was named Nurse of the Year by the Veterans Administration. Colonel Kammermeyer plans on taking her case to federal court. This is not the first time Colonel Kammermeyer challenged military procedure. In the 60s, she appealed policies on marriage and pregnancy and won. Colonel Kammermeyer has four sons. She was divorced in 1980. I asked her what her reaction was to being discharged for revealing that she's a lesbian.
My reaction, I guess, is that I was hurt and disappointed, felt as though I had been negated and my service had been negated since I had already been in the military for 26 years, served my country, and felt that my records should speak for themselves. And so it was very painful. It still is. And on next Thursday, or the 11th of June, when I have to actually turn in my ID card and turn over the rest of the my uniform and that sort of thing, then I'm not quite sure how it'll feel inside, but I'm expecting it to feel pretty bad.
What have you been told about why you have to leave?
Well, it's not a matter of what I've been told, it's what the regulation says. I mean, there are two aspects of that regulation. One is that supposedly, if you're homosexual, you're a security risk, and the second is that you're bad for morale and would undermine the mission of the military, essentially. And, you know, neither of those have any bearing or are grounded in reality. It was a policy that was developed out of World War II and has gotten progressively more rigid, so that even just saying that you're lesbian, which I did, is sufficient grounds now for discharge.
You came out during an interview for a promotion to chief military nurse. This was back in 1989.
If I could clarify.
Yeah.
I came out as part of a top-secret investigation clearance that I had requested so that I could go to the War College or apply for the War College to be competitive to apply for the position of National Guard Chief Nurse.
Now, so the question was asked to you about your sexual preference during this security clearance interview?
There was like a dozen pages of just straightforward questions that were asked one after another, to which you sort of knee-jerked a response, is what it appeared to me like. And one of the questions had to do with homosexuality, to which I replied that I was a lesbian.
So did you think at all that your wish to go to the war college and your need for a security clearance might end up in your discharge from the military? I mean, had that possibility entered your mind?
Well, only when I answered the question did I feel like I had sort of, my career was over and that I sort of saw my military life sort of pass before me and go out the window. I mean, there was a sinking feeling that I had. And then I sort of tried to regroup in my mind, I think, and say, well, perhaps they would look at my records. And, you know, the military has always looked at things clearly and seen when they have been wrong, because I'd had some disagreements with the military in the past, and in each case, reason had prevailed, and I had won my appeals for various things. And so I was hoping that perhaps that would occur in this particular case also.
Why did you reply yes? You could have lied.
No, I couldn't. I mean, that wasn't an option. You know, I'm an officer. I'm a soldier. I was going for top secret clearance for hoping to, you know, get into a position where, you know, trust and integrity and honesty are the sort of the standard. And that just couldn't be.
Had you thought about how you were going to answer it before you got there, if you were asked that, because you thought maybe it was a possibility that you'd be asked?
No, I hadn't. I hadn't really dwelled on it very much. It was just going into the next phase and sort of taking whatever came. Because it was not that big a deal, you know. Okay, I'm going to have a security clearance. We'll go through. We'll talk, and we'll move on from there. And again, you know, I kept on thinking about the record that I already have. You know, I'm an educated person. I've been around for a while and have a military track record. And believed that Uncle Sam would take those things into consideration regardless. And I knew that, you know, at least I could not be blackmailed, which was one of the major concerns having to do with the security clearance.
Right, because you'd be a security risk if you were subject to blackmail.
Yeah, you would think so. And the irony being that the blackmail that really occurred after the fact was from the military. I think that, you know, part of it was to try, after the fact, was to try to encourage me to resign or retire rather than to become a public laughingstock or the public display that has come about as a result of it.
How exactly did you answer the question? And I'm wondering if you looked your interviewer in the eye or if you looked at your shoes while you were answering.
I looked him in the eye and I said, I am a lesbian, period. That was all that I said. And that's, you know, sort of, that's it.
Did it get a reaction or just a check mark on the questionnaire?
Well, he started asking other questions. And, you know, we proceeded on and talked about, you know, just because someone says that they are homosexual, what they are saying has to do with sexual orientation, and that's all that has to do with. And, you know, I felt like perhaps I could enlighten him a little bit in the process of all of that. And so we talked for a little while, and I thought that he sort of was understanding. I mean, this, you know, when you're naive in this business, you really are very naive and can assume that there is a sense of understanding when what they're really trying to do is to undermine and to pull together whatever they can to, you know, to finish their case or to get something. I mean, you know, the irony of all of this, if I can just digress a little bit, is, you know, I had the security clearance. The investigation took place. The board hearing took place. My discharge took place in July of last year. in October of last year, 4 months after the board had already decided that I was going to be discharged, the investigative services came back again to reopen the security investigation. I asked them, you know, why they were doing this, and they at one point said the Department of Army wanted more information and the investigation to be reopened, and the second time they said that the National Guard wanted it. You know, it's like, what's the point? It's moot. I'm going to be discharged from the military as long as that regulation is in place. But then they went around and interviewed people at my work. They went back to all sorts of people that I had worked with in the past, trying to get other names from them of who I might have had work relation or social relation with. I mean, I'm a nurse. And you know, what I was seeking was to continue in my nursing profession. I mean, I could not understand what was going on.
So why do you think they're still investigating you for the security clearance? Do you think that there are ulterior motives here?
You know, you're talking about a government system. I don't know. It seems a little bit peculiar to me.
Mm-hmm. What effect did it have on you personally to say to the investigator that you were a lesbian?
There was sort of this combination of, well, it's out now, and this really is who I am. It was a long process in getting to acknowledge that, and then to make it public was sort of this, well, what's going to happen now? If not only what about my career, but you know, if people that I know find out, you know, my family finds out, is that going to sort of make me the bad person that homosexuals are supposed to be? And so there was a lot of feeling of loneliness, of emptiness, and wondering sort of just what my life was going to be like.
Was this in a way a coming out for you? I mean, did you almost come out to yourself when you said this?
I think it allowed me to feel integrated, and in some sense that I think so.
So you hadn't really kind of admitted to yourself?
No, I think, you know, there are some things that probably as you look back are more clear. The hindsight being crystal clear, but that as you're working through a process of self-identification, of understanding who you are, and especially having come from the background that I came from, the very traditional and naive background that I had, that the struggle in some ways was different, and because I had been married and have 4 sons, and so all of the things were new, you know, and learning about myself, and it's a tremendous struggle. I think it's almost like being an adolescent all over again, and maybe that's why the past 2 years I really felt like I was 20, because it's trying to learn who I am. And in my mind's eye, I am young. My hair tells me otherwise, and so do my children. But it is, I think, an evolving process for all of us.
I know you were worried about the reaction that you'd get within the military. What has surprised you about the reaction that you have gotten?
Well, you know, I can't even put words to amazement that I have had, because everyone from my children to the patients that I work with to my coworkers in civilian life, and the support from the military, at least the National Guard, and some of the people that I have worked with in the past, and even my patients from the past, have called and sent telegrams. I get care packages from the employer of a friend of mine. It has just been phenomenal.
Lieutenant Margaret Kammermeyer is my guest. She's been discharged for being a lesbian. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Colonel Margaret Kammermeyer, one of the highest-ranking military officers to be discharged for homosexuality. You've been in the military for 30 years. I'm going to ask you, if you would, to share one of your most vivid memories from your career. I know you were in Vietnam during the Tet Offensive, working in a hospital.
Well, I think, you know, I had some extraordinarily tragic memories of patients that I was involved with, but there was one just, you know, to show the uniqueness, the wonderful character of the soldiers that we cared for. I was a head nurse of a neurosurgical intensive care unit there, and there was a young man who had essentially lost half of his brain. And we were not expecting him to survive. We ended up taking him back and forth to the operating room several times because of complications, and he just didn't respond at all. He didn't die, and he stabilized, and so we were getting him ready to come home. And we always talked to them, the soldiers, before anything happened, and, you know, that's one of the premises of nursing, is that hearing is the last of the senses to go, so talk, and maybe the message will be heard even though they may not be able to respond. And so I went over and I said, Leroy, we're getting you ready to go home. And he only had one eye left, and he opened it for the first time. And, you know, it was, I personally sort of couldn't believe it. And I said, you're going to be going home. We're sending you first by helicopter down to Tonsonut, and then you'll go to Japan, and then you'll go home. And this is a guy now we had had for a month who hadn't given any idea that he was still there. And he took his hand that he could still move, raised it, and gave, you know, like the high sign. And, I mean, we all fell apart. You know, I cried. Everybody on the ward came over, you know, and it was sort of an affirmation of everything that we were doing there had the potential of value. And, you know, I see him in my mind's eye, and he is one of those hallmarks that, you know, you wonder, how is he doing? Is he still alive? You know, all of those things that you never know. But that was probably one of the more nice, meaningful events.
Obviously, this is the kind of work you get very emotionally involved with.
But you're not supposed to. You know, my teachers always said you're not supposed to get emotionally involved. To which my response has been, how can you not? And the advantage in the Army has been, or in the military, is that you never know when you're going to see someone again. And so it's not that you might not be friends or might not be stationed together somewhere else. but you do get hooked. I mean, you get hooked because you're all together in the family. I mean, it really is a large family.
The military?
Yes.
Is that what's kept you in the military all these years?
I love the military. I love serving my country. I love wearing the uniform. I feel good serving and being part of it.
You only have a few days left in which you will be allowed to be part of the military. What are those next few days looking like to you?
Well, my drill weekend is coming up this coming weekend. I have some projects that I need to finish off and some people I need to say goodbye to. It's going to be difficult. And on the 11th, I go to turn in my gear and turn in my ID card. And I'm just going to have to sort of regroup with all of that when it's taking place, I guess.
Do you know what you'll be doing professionally after you leave the military on June 11th?
I work in a civilian hospital. I'm a nurse clinical specialist, and there has been no effect on my job. So I will continue to do that work. And when some of these things die down, perhaps I can get back to doing my clinical research.
Do you feel that in challenging the ban against gays and lesbians in the military that you're serving your country, but in a different way?
That's been my way of rationalizing the loss, you know, in a way. It's a bit like, well, I don't always know what I'm supposed to do in this world, but there must be a reason why these things are happening as they are. And if I can't serve in one way, then perhaps I'm supposed to serve in another. And I think that the military will be a much better place once that regulation is eliminated. And if that becomes what I need to do, then I will.
Colonel Margaret Kammermeier. We called the Pentagon to comment on the colonel's discharge and the military ban on homosexuality. A spokesperson who is handling this case declined to comment on tape, but he told us Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney has stated he has no intention of changing the policy that states homosexuality is incompatible with military service. General Colin Powell addressed this policy in February before the House Armed Services Committee. Powell said it's difficult in a military setting where there is no privacy to introduce a group of individuals who are proud, brave, loyal, good Americans, but who prefer a homosexual lifestyle, and put them in with the heterosexuals who'd prefer not to have somebody of the same sex find them sexually attractive, and put them in close proximity, asking heterosexuals and homosexuals to share the most private facilities together, such as the bedroom, the barracks, the latrines, and the showers. I think that's a very difficult problem to give the military. It would be prejudicial to good order and discipline to try to integrate that in the current military structure. End quote, General Colin Powell. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Environmentalist Roger Stone says that the most significant obstacle to stopping environmental degradation is poverty, that rainforests and coral reefs in the developing world are often depleted for their dollar value because there are no economic alternatives. Coming up, we talk with Stone, senior fellow at the World Wildlife Fund, about some projects that are satisfying both economic and environmental concerns. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews Jay Leno's Tonight Show, now in its second week. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. At the Earth Summit meeting in Rio, the president of Brazil has become the first head of state to sign the Global Climate Treaty. NPR's Scott Simon reports that environmentalists attending the conference say, though, the treaty is fundamentally flawed.
Greenpeace International, among a number of other non-governmental organizations, argues the compromise made during negotiations to win the agreement of the United States has already made the treaty mostly meaningless. It sets no specific goals for nations to meet in reducing the emissions of greenhouse gases, and it calls for no specific commitments from industrial nations to help the developing world replace fossil fuel-burning machinery with new and cleaner technology. But UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali argues that the treaty is the best that could be produced, given U.S. refusal to commit to specific goals. A climate change treaty, said the Secretary General, which lacked the U.S.'s signature, would be meaningless. And if the treaty does not require specific reductions in carbon dioxide emissions, it does commit nations to the general idea of reducing greenhouse gases. This is Scott Simon in Rio.
Officials of Bosnia are calling for urgent foreign military aid to save civilians under siege. The foreign minister says thousands of people need food, water, and medicine. And because of continued fighting, they cannot even bury their dead. According to local reporters, Serbian tanks and artillery have hit hard at one part of the capital, where some 40,000 people have been trapped for weeks now. The foreign minister wants military escorts for aid convoys or armed outside military intervention. Meeting today in Oslo, NATO ministers approved the use of NATO forces in peacekeeping roles in Europe, but efforts by the United States to take steps toward action in the Yugoslav conflict were turned down. NPR's John Edstey reports from London.
The decision will allow NATO's troops and equipment to be used in keeping the peace anywhere in Europe. It reverses a decades-old policy restricting the use of alliance forces to the territory of NATO countries. But even as they were approving this new role for NATO, European ministers were resisting efforts by the United States to say specifically that NATO's resources stand ready to be used in the Yugoslav conflict. The U.S. representative to the meeting, Deputy Secretary of State Lawrence Eagleburger, said NATO should be ready to support the implementation of sanctions imposed last week by the U.N. He also urged the alliance to support the delivery of humanitarian aid to Bosnia-Herzegovina. But the Europeans, who don't want the alliance to be dragged into the conflict, wouldn't go along with the language. I'm John Edstey in London.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 7 points to close at 3,399.73 on volume of 192 million shares. Declining issues led advances by a margin of 9-7. This is NPR News. The New York Times is reporting that Ross Perot talked about private business ventures with Vietnam after his trip there in 1987 to look for U.S. prisoners of war. According to the newspaper, the Texas billionaire acknowledged a 1990 letter in which Vietnamese officials named him a business agent of their government once relations between the two nations were normalized. But he said that any business discussions were started by Vietnamese officials and were merely philosophical in nature. He also said that he ignored the letter. In Miami, the first co-defendant in Manuel Noriega's drug trafficking and racketeering trial has been sentenced. Melissa Mancini reports from Miami.
Roberto Streitinger is one of two prosecution witnesses that placed General Noriega at a meeting with Medellin cocaine cartel leaders. Streitinger, a convicted drug pilot, testified last October he saw Panama's ousted leader with Pablo Escobar and the Ochoa brothers. In exchange for his testimony against Noriega, Streitinger entered into a plea agreement with the government. Prior to sentencing, U.S. prosecutors recognized Streitinger's cooperation in obtaining a guilty verdict against Noriega. They also acknowledged his assistance with a current government investigation. Today, Streitinger was sentenced to 5 years in prison. He's already spent about 2 years behind bars and, according to U.S. prosecutors, could be released within a year's time. For National Public Radio, I'm Melissa Mancini in Miami.
In Germany, the government says that that nation's economy expanded in the first quarter of this year, and unemployment was down in both eastern and western Germany. At the same time, however, top officials warned that a temporary slowdown could occur in the second quarter of the year. And the U.S. government says that business plans to increase capital spending this year by 4.7%. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. At the Earth Summit in Rio, representatives from around the world are trying to figure out policies that would protect the environment while still encouraging economic growth. This is an issue my guest Roger Stone has been studying for the World Wildlife Fund, where he's a senior fellow. Before he was an environmentalist, he was a vice president at Chase Manhattan Bank. He reports on his findings in his new book, The Nature of Development. This project took him to Latin America, Asia, and Africa, looking for examples of what worked and what failed. One of the great failures was an Amazonian settlement in Brazil, created after the world's largest deposit of high-grade iron ore was discovered. Gold was found there, too.
Brazil had always assumed that the Amazon would be the future of the country, in effect. More than half the landscape containing, allegedly at least, vast riches of minerals, of forest products, potential of other sorts that would finally transform Brazil into a great country. So when these discoveries were made, the government back in the 1960s and early 1970s made a heavy bet, made a $62 billion bet, or tried to raise that amount of money anyway, that all this would really come true. As a result of that bet, vast numbers of people began to flock into the area to take advantage of what they perceived would be a bonanza. And some of those people succeeded. Some of them, a few of them, got stable jobs in the mining areas and the hydroelectric dam installations that were put up. But most of the jobs were construction jobs and deforestation jobs that required the use of a chainsaw out in the forest. And what was left after all that phase happened was former forest, now degraded landscape. For ecological reasons, that kind of landscape cannot sustain very many people. It's hard to farm on former tropical forest because the soil underneath the towering trees is very poor. It's hard to raise cattle. And so what happened was that most of the people, once they'd gotten in the area, stuck there without the money to escape, without any forest left to proceed into, at least nearby, were stuck in what became vast failing agricultural and cattle-raising colonization projects, or in the kind of insta-towns that grew up around the big installations. And there was nothing and is nothing for them to do there.
Describe what the towns around there are like now.
Well, this town, Parauapebas, started out as a camp for the construction workers who went up the hill every morning to work on what is a very successful iron ore mine called Carajás. When the construction jobs ran out, the workers didn't go away. Other people, in fact, arrived and continued to arrive. And the whole place just grew and grew. When I first saw it, it had only a few thousand inhabitants. Now it has 50,000. And as the Brazilian population booms and as people continue to move in to the area, it's continuing to grow and grow. There's no work for any of those people. They take in each other's laundry. Sanitation conditions, the health conditions, the education conditions in this town are all very primitive. There are no public funds to support it particularly. Prostitution is probably the leading activity among the female population. It just is a dreadful place that never should have been allowed to exist. And the reason is that the planning for the region was all done from outside and from the top down. No one asked those Amazonians, the newcomers, let alone the indigenous populations who inhabited the area before them, what they wanted to have happen to the area. They didn't ask for the dams and the mines and the whatever. They would have been much better off, in fact, if the forest had been allowed to remain in place.
Now, I'm going to ask you to contrast the project that you just described in Brazil with a project in Latin America or one of the other countries that you visited that you think was much more successful because it was better planned and because local people were involved in the planning.
The contrasting example that I would offer comes from Northwest Ecuador, a place neglected both by the Ecuadorian government and by the world, where there have traditionally lived a group of Indians called the Awá and some in a town called San Lorenzo along the coast. Some descendants of a slave ship wreck that occurred back at the end of the 16th century. These people farmed and fished tranquilly, although in poverty, up until 1950, when the Ecuadorian government awarded a logging concession to a private company. The loggers came in, employed practically everybody around, and cut down almost all the trees to the point where, in 1980 or so, the citizens, both on the Indian side and in the town of San Lorenzo, began to wake up and realize that their trees were just about gone, that the climate was changing because of the lack of trees, the water supply was in jeopardy. All kinds of changes had taken place in their community, and they worried about their future and what was going to happen after the last tree went, and they began to organize against that eventuality. And they formed cooperatives, they tried to diversify their farming, they began to think of new ways to make more than a very bare subsistence income. And they eventually attracted the attention of the foreign sector, foreign agencies, both public and private, came in and helped them get themselves organized to face the future sustainably. As of the present time, it certainly is not true that they've conquered all their problems, but they have developed many new programs and activities, education, health, diversified agriculture, and so forth, and they are currently facing the future with a great deal more confidence and security than the people of the benighted town of Paroapebas in the eastern Brazilian Amazon that I previously described to you.
My guest is Roger Stone, author of the new book, The Nature of Development. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest Roger Stone is a senior fellow with the World Wildlife Fund. His new book is a study of development projects and their effects on the environment. I want to get back to your example in Ecuador.
Yeah.
What you're describing in Ecuador sounds like a first step, but it doesn't sound like something really remarkable. Is there something really remarkable that you saw in your travels?
None of these examples are really remarkable, except in the sense that Armageddon has been avoided. Many of the examples that I saw all over the world are instances in which people would have ended up just like the poor benighted citizens of this town of Paroapebas in Brazil, had it not been for certain changes that took place in their course.
One of the places you visited was a development project that included a highway on the Brazil-Peru border. This was funded by the Inter-American Development Bank. In 1987, the bank told Brazil that payments under the loan agreements would be suspended unless there was more evidence that the developers were complying with the bank's environmental provisions. Now, what difference did that make? You know, now that places like the Inter-American Development Bank have environmental provisions.
It really is case by case. There are still instances in which the banks themselves choose to overlook the fact that their environmental rules are not being obeyed. The traditional role of those lending agencies has been to lend money the same way a bank lends money. And its most important concern has been getting those loans repaid. If you or I were to take out a bank loan and tell the banker that we needed the money so we could pay our kids' tuition, and then took that money and went out and bought a fancy car with it, the bank might or might not notice that we had done something different from what we said we were going to do. Probably not. And that's the way that the banks have traditionally felt about these projects. Getting repaid, acting as a traditional banker has been primary. Now it's a little bit different. It's a controversial subject. These environmental so-called conditionalities, to use the jargon, I think are going to have to be applied. I don't think we can afford anymore, given the constraints, the economic and financial constraints on all governments and all people and all countries, we can't afford to send development assistance money to poor countries and have it end up in the president's Swiss bank account. And we've got to develop mechanisms to make sure that doesn't happen. This is not a popular concept among developing countries. What they want is additionality, to add another level of jargon, that is more money to cope with environmental problems over and above their very basic problems of health and nutrition and education and so forth. But I think that, and I agree that there should be more money, but I think that it should come with conditions attached, and I think we should develop the mechanisms to monitor how that money is being used to make sure those conditions are met.
We have representatives of environmental groups and of development groups and governmental groups meeting now at the Earth Summit. Since you have worked in different arenas, I wonder if you think that there are areas in which environmentalists need to change their thinking and areas in which developers need to change their thinking.
No question about it. A lot of what we're hearing currently on the air and in the press is that this is an Earth Summit which will either succeed dramatically or fail dramatically. I don't think it will do either. I think some decisions will be made. Some agreements will not be reached. The importance of it is the convergence of this incredible diversity of people around a set of ideas that are relatively new to the world, tremendously important, and many of them are going to take years and decades even to sort out. But this summit, with all its hot air and all its hoopla, nevertheless serves as a benchmark on which the world is going to build in the future.
So do you think that both environmentalists and developers need to change their thinking a little bit? I wonder what your brief critique of each would be.
Well, it depends on the issue. I think environmentalists certainly needed to learn that you couldn't build fences around forests imaginary fences, if you will, around important marine areas and preserve biological diversity in any meaningful way. Environmentalists had to learn to engage the world. Environmentalists had to learn that the bureaucracies like the people who govern the rules of trade around the world, that govern the flow of public and private capital around the world, are part of the game. They couldn't be ignored. Environmentalists just couldn't put up signs and protest these things. They had to engage at a broader level the society of which they were a part. Development people certainly had to learn the limits of the carrying capacity, to use the ecological term, of many areas, had to learn that the environment had to be a consideration, otherwise the development would fail. They had to learn that it would be important to work with local communities, not just sit around in capitals of rich nations thousands of miles away and draw plans on paper. Development had to learn that this was more than a matter for economists and engineers to decide, sociological factors, anthropological, cultural factors, as well as environmental factors had to be very much a part of the game. I think that to a certain extent, although there are gaps remaining and in some instances wide gaps, that learning has taken place, and I'm encouraged to think of its continuing in that direction.
Your project, studying development and environmental concerns in tropical areas, this project was initiated by William Riley when he was the head of the World Wildlife Fund. Now Riley is heading the U.S. delegation to the Earth Summit in his capacity as head of the Environmental Protection Agency. How do you think he's doing in those roles?
I think he's doing remarkably well, obviously. I think that William Riley, over the course of his term at EPA, has won a few, lost a few. What he has been successful in doing against heavy odds is what I think of as keeping the playing field in the ballpark. In contrast to what happened during the early years of the Reagan administration when everything went anti-environmental, William Riley has succeeded in winning a few, has had to accept more than his share of knocks along the way, but as I say, has at least maintained some decency in the overall environmental profile of the administration. Things would be infinitely worse were it not for his presence.
Who are the villains now in tropical development?
It's hard to divide the world between heroes and villains. Certainly there are some corporations that have yet to learn, as a lot of other corporations have, that economics and the environment are not deadly enemies, that profits and economic prosperity for the shareholders and for the managers of the corporation can only come at the expense of the environment. I think there are lots of companies that still need to learn those lessons, although many of them have learned very well. In a generic sense, the growth of the world's population and almost all of that growth taking place in developing countries is what you might refer to as a villain. It's going to be awfully hard for the world to achieve sustainability in the senses that I've tried to describe it without more effective measures to decrease the explosive rate of population growth. I wish this is a subject that we're getting more attention in Rio. Unfortunately, it's kind of peripheral.
Roger Stone is the author of the new book, The Nature of Development. Tomorrow, he's flying down to Rio to attend the Earth Summit. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, I know NPR has a big crew down at the Earth Summit in Rio. What do you have from there?
Scott Simon is going to file today, Terry. This is the first real day of work at the conference. Among other things, they worked on the carbon dioxide treaty. And we'll also have interviews with four delegates from around the world about what they hope to do with the conference. We're also going to spend some time today trying to understand some more about Yugoslavia and what the United Nations position and the U.S. position is. We'll have an interview with our ambassador to Yugoslavia, who's been recalled and is in Washington now. And we'll talk to Adam Hochberg about a new invention which restores vision.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. It's been almost two full weeks since the premiere of The Tonight Show with Jay Leno. Time enough, says TV critic David Bianculli, to judge what the show's doing right and doing wrong.
From the NBC studios in Burbank, California, The Tonight Show with Jay Leno. Featuring Bradford Marsalis and The Tonight Show Band. Tonight, Jay welcomes Harrison Ford. Comedian Lily Anderson, the music of John Cicada, and from NBC News, Star Jones, I'm Ed Hall, and now Jay Leno.
Unlike a lot of people who dumped on Jay Leno the very first night, I took a wait-and-see attitude. Well, I've waited and I've seen. And though some things are every bit as bad as they say, Leno is starting to get comfortable again, and the rest is easily fixable. Let's get the bad stuff out of the way first. Back when Leno guest-hosted The Tonight Show once a week, his monologues were crisper and funnier. Having to turn out one a night has lowered his punchline batting average a lot. But as the new writing staff gets adjusted to the pace, that ought to improve. The range of musical guests on The New Tonight Show is a bit too wide. The Black Crows one night, Kathleen Battle the next. I appreciate what Leno and bandleader Branford Marsalis are trying to do, but at midnight, if you come up against someone too far removed from your own personal tastes, you're not going to sit through it, like you would with the Ed Sullivan Show. You're going to sleep through it, or change channels. Another thing that's easily corrected is Leno's desire to flatter all his guests and praise, as well as plug, their new projects. Great movie, great album, great book. Here's how he started to set up a Patriot Games clip last night with guest Harrison Ford.
Let's talk a little about Patriot Games. Now, I saw it the other night, and, gee, I thought it was great. I mean, it's a real thinking man's thriller. I don't know what you'd call it, I suppose.
I'll live with that.
The thing I liked about it was I liked sort of the attention to detail. Mm-hmm. Like when you go in,
the fact that the guests are on The Tonight Show is an implied seal of approval, so Leno should minimize the compliments. He should also loosen up and slow down during the interviews. Last week's conversation with Mel Gibson was horrible. Leno misinterpreted one of Gibson's remarks and made it sound racist. And Leno's chats with literary humorists have fallen as flat as some of Saturday Night Live's all-time worst sketches. Take Molly Ivins, please. But that first week was a nervous one, and was broadcast live. On tape this week, Leno has started to act like a talk show host instead of a substitute teacher. And when he gets either a guest or a topic he feels comfortable with, or both, he does just fine. Here's a sample from his Tuesday night conversation with Christian Slater. The young actor had just returned from a movie shoot in the Midwest by buying a 61 Cadillac and driving it home. And Leno's well-known automobile expertise drove the conversation home.
Now, what'd you pay for that? Let's see. Let me guess. 61 Caddy, four-door, two-door?
Four-door.
A four-door.
Yeah.
That is desirable. Air?
Sorry, Jay.
Air?
How many cars do you have, by the way?
Air? Does that have air?
Oh, we all have air.
No air. Okay, that's going to cut the value a little bit
more. You roll down the window, you get the air.
Or the electric windows?
No.
I'm looking at a stripper here. What color is it, black?
No, it's light blue.
Leather interior?
Sure, Jay, yeah.
Leno's late-night rivals, who were on vacation his first week, are taking their best shots now. Last night, while Leno talked with Harrison Ford, Arsenio Hall had Bill Clinton sitting in with a studio band and playing saxophone. Standing there and holding his sax, grinning at every one of Hall's jokes and digs, Clinton looked pretty stupid. But when he got to the chair and talked with Hall about the L.A. riots, he sounded better than he did on sax. And Arsenio won that night's must-see talk show contest. Oh, and just for the record, Branford Marsalis doesn't have to worry. But on God Bless the Child, Clinton did better than expected. Play us out to the break, okay, Bill?
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Spolin and Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a composer's personal response to the AIDS epidemic, we talk with John Corigliano. A visit to the AIDS Memorial Quilt several years ago inspired him to write his Symphony No. 1. As one critic said, it stands on its own as a piece of music and as a moving tribute to those who have died. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.